Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Ahead in this hour, finding our way back to agreeing to disagree agreeably, and another Eastern Standard 10-minute radio play, this one a true story about moonshiners. First, we're joined now by Robert Farley, a prolific author. Dr. Farley teaches courses in security and diplomacy at the University of Kentucky's Patterson School. I invited him to share some insights about some of the issues that arise as competition between democracy and authoritarianism seems to be on the rise around the world. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Farley.
Thank you for having me.
As one who studies these matters, what's your impression of this seeming drift from traditional American democracy, flawed as it may be, in the direction of some form of authoritarianism in America?
Well, I have a lot of feelings about this. I think on the one hand, it's important to note that this is not simply an American phenomenon, that in democracies around the world, even established democracies, you are seeing the rise of what I think is very fair to characterize as anti-democratic elements. Now, these elements often cloak themselves in populism, but they're very hostile to process. They're very hostile to procedure. They're very hostile to any sort of established order. And so this isn't just an American thing. It's certainly happening all over Europe, less prevalent, I think, in Asia, but certainly a significant European and even Latin American phenomenon. And in the United States, too. Sometimes I think in trying to explain our current situation to people, it's almost too shocking to consider that we had a president who attempted a coup to remain in office, and now we are strongly considering reelecting that president to the same role. And that is straightforwardly authoritarian creep, right? I mean, it's a lack of interest on a significant portion of the electorate in liberal democracy and in the procedures and processes which characterize liberal democracy.
Well, for a little bit of a historical perspective, we've never had anything quite like this, but we have flirted deep in the past with authoritarian tendencies, correct?
Well, I'm not sure that we've ever seen quite in the United States this sense of disdain and contempt for the process of democracy. Now, there are certainly times in our past and even in our fairly recent past where we have not been democratic in the traditional sense of the term or the liberal sense of the term, right? Obviously, African-Americans were restricted from the franchise for a very long time in the United States. Women were restricted from the franchise for a very long time in the United States. And so the United States has, in what one might term objective terms, become more democratic over its history. But really, the last time that people were worried in the United States about a Caesar-esque figure becoming an authoritarian leader, I mean, you almost have to go back, certainly depiction of Lincoln in the 19th century in the American South. They described him as a Caesar. But before that, you have to look at the 18th century when people were really worried whether the experiment would work at all. And so I would say that what we're looking at right now is quite unprecedented in American political history.
You touched on this a second ago. In its purest form, I guess, democracy could be defined as the rule of the people. Citizens supposedly have the right to take part in decision-making of the nation. But would you say the discontent that we're hearing loudly in today's America is born out of a sense that this is no longer true, that participation really isn't possible?
I certainly think that there's something to that, right? That the government and sort of the levers of control over our government feel distant from us in a lot of ways. That for a lot of people, the real difference between an authoritarian and a democratic government in their daily lives may not be very easy to discern. Right? That they may understand it in abstract terms, but not in concrete terms, and especially not in terms that are concrete enough for them to distinguish between one candidate and another candidate. But I'm not sure that that's an entirely new phenomenon either, right? Government has always been distant from us in some fashion. And today, Americans can interact with their elected leaders in ways, I think, that are much more direct than they could have 30, 40, 50 years ago, right? And this is because of the rise of social media, different kinds of media. And so, it is interesting to me that this change in the media landscape has accompanied this tolerance for authoritarianism.
Well, to get a sense of what this might mean, what America might become under an authoritarian president, should we be looking at the regimes of other contemporary autocrats, say Prime Minister Viktor Orban in Hungary, for example? Are there any close parallels in other parts of the world?
So I think Orban is a fabulous, fantastic parallel, and he's a great parallel not only because he has effectively weaponized government in order to maintain his power and maintain the power of his party in Hungary. He has mobilized the same kind of rhetoric we see from the American right against wokeness, against immigration, but he's also openly lauded by many figures on the American right. You know, I don't think that the American right has a monopoly on anti-democratic thinking. Right, you can find parts of the left historically and now which have been undemocratic or at least have not had much value for democracy. But right now, many on the American right treat Orban as a hero and a model for what the next GOP presidency should look like, whether that be President Trump or someone else. And so, yeah, I think he's a great figure for pointing at this is what happens, right? It's a kind of soft autocracy. People still have speech. Elections are still held, but those elections, if they're not quite fixed, they are heavily slanted towards the ruling party, and you increasingly have less and less in terms of democratic debate in Hungary.
Well, it feels as though we are right now in this moment, and depending on the outcome of the November election, which is less than a year away, we're in the midst of a possible transition from the democracy that we're familiar with, flawed as it may be, to some form of autocracy. Is that a fair and reasonable observation at this point?
I am very concerned about the future of American democracy right now. And for the reasons that we have discussed, that a significant portion of the American population doesn't seem to place much value on democracy anymore. A significant portion of the population seems fine with dictatorship as long as the dictator is someone that they support. And so, yeah, I mean, I think values of tolerance and values of discussion and debate, and especially the idea that democracy is about process rather than just outcome, is becoming a much harder sell in the United States. And so, yeah, I would agree that we are facing a significant choice. Whichever way that choice goes in November, the problem is not going to go away, right? It's probably something that's going to recur over time until I'm not really sure when we're going to get rid of it, right? It seems to be something that is baked into how we do politics in the United States right now.
Well, it's pretty evident that a lot of people favor this drift toward autocracy. And I just wonder, are we in a watch what you wish for moment? Do you think American citizens fully comprehend what it would mean to live under autocratic rule?
I think that Americans, and not just Americans, people of every political bent, there is always this dictatorship and authoritarianism always offer a certain temptation, right? That if you're frustrated that President Biden was not able to get all of his proposals through, if you're frustrated that President Biden hasn't been able to support Ukraine, or if you're frustrated that President Trump wasn't able to fire the entire federal judiciary, then dictatorship and authoritarianism can feel quite tempting, right? It is about sweeping away all of the obstacles that prevent the government from doing what the government needs to be done, whatever that may be, right? Wealth redistribution or closing the border or whatever else. And, you know, generally speaking, Americans have been pretty good about not surrendering to that temptation, right? And we have the oldest procedural democracy in the world for a reason. But this time around, it feels a little bit unusual in that the pro-authoritarian forces are not disguising their authoritarianism, right? President Trump has spoken about being a dictator on day one. You have 2025 plan, which is for a major revision of American life. And so I think that if we find ourselves in January of 2025 and President Trump takes the oath of office again, then I think, yes, quite a few people are going to be extremely surprised and unpleasantly surprised by what that regime will look like.
As a society such as ours is going through such a transition from our democracy into something different, some sort of authoritarian or autocratic structure, what comes out of that? What sort of issues does that friction create?
So that's a good question, and I think it's very hard to predict. The first thing is that in his first term, President Trump sort of came to the realization that the bureaucracy of the United States government does not work like the bureaucracy of the Trump Corporation. And he found that immensely frustrating. And he's, you know, that has been one of his key moments on the campaign trail now, is insisting that this is going to change. But saying you're going to destroy bureaucracy is different than actually doing it. And there are going to be immense legal and procedural obstacles, even if Trump wins, even if Trump has majorities in both the House and the Senate, to actually doing a lot of the stuff that he's talked about in Project 2025. And so I think that that is going to manifest in a lot of frustration on the part of Trump supporters, who are expecting a significant transformation in this first year, and they probably aren't going to get it, right? What we're going to see is conflict and infighting within the GOP. You're going to see a sort of a well-structured resistance among Democrats and others. And so it's going to be conflictual, right, is the first thing, right, that it's going to have a lot of friction and there'll be a lot of conflict. I think a second thing is unique to the United States, which is our system is very federal, right? And so there is a lot that can happen in Washington that will not touch states which don't have the president's majority in their party, right? And you will see states like California and New York and Illinois and so forth mounting what we might imagine to be active resistance against the federal government, probably not in a military sense, but certainly in a legal and bureaucratic sense.
Well, so potentially a very rocky road ahead, a very rough road ahead, potentially.
I think that if President Trump wins, it is not potentially. It will be a very rocky road ahead.
Well, I'm really curious, Dr. Farley, does this subject come up in your classroom? Do students seem tuned into it and concerned?
Oh, I would say yes. I mean, most of my students are graduate students who focus on foreign policy. Mm-hmm. So we don't really spend a lot of time debating issues of domestic politics. We have both Republicans and Democrats in my classes. And so it's probably a good thing that we don't spend a lot of time on domestic politics. But absolutely, students are aware that this is a potential change happening to the United States. Students are aware that this is not something that's limited to the United States, right? That you have this transnational activist right that has these authoritarian underpinnings, and that therefore it's an international issue, right? And so, you know, I think my own students have that sense of perspective because they do have the international experience, they do have the international interest, and so they know it's not just something that's happening in the United States. It's not unique to the United States. But yeah, I think there's a great deal. There's a great deal of concern. And we have people who are supporters of President Trump in my classes. And they, you know, they feel free to argue what they're going to argue. And they have a different perspective, of course, than I do about, you know, what the future of the United States is going to look like. But they share a lot of the frustrations of President Trump's other supporters.
Are these often civil conversations and debates?
They are civil when I am around. I cannot promise that they are civil when I am not around, and I've heard that they can get uncivil very quickly. But I do try to maintain as much civility as possible in my classroom.
Robert Farley, professor at the University of Kentucky's Patterson School, where he teaches courses in security and diplomacy. Dr. Farley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When we return,
healthy disagreement is good for democracy. The problem is that the disagreement that we have now is unhealthy.
How a group called Braver Angels aims to return civility to conversations about politics and policy. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. We're back with more of this week's edition of Eastern Standard. Are you having a hard time even imagining talking politics in a group of people, even family and friends? These days, that can feel like walking into a minefield. Is this polarization genie out of the bottle? Braver Angels is a national grassroots organization that promotes political depolarization. And they're making plans to host a series of three workshops in Lexington between now and June 1st, to bring people who identify as red or blue, Democrat or Republican, conservative or liberal, into the same room to sit down and try to work out their differences, or at least find a way to talk to each other. Sound like a tall order? Carolyn DuPont, a professor of history at Eastern Kentucky University, is Kentucky State Coordinator for Braver Angels. She leads a chapter in Jessamine County. Thanks for joining us, Carolyn.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I think it's safe to say that, at least in my lifetime, I've never witnessed the degree of polarization and division that we're experiencing in this country today. As a historian, would you agree?
Well, I would say we have had remarkable times of polarization. And I think sometimes we forget about the intense polarization, say, of the 1790s. Or, you know, do we need to be reminded that we did have a civil war at one point? So we've had these occasions before. Each one is unique. I think we're in a unique moment right now that's certainly new in the memory of most of us living.
It seems like this angry, vitriolic divisiveness is going to become even worse given our options in the presidential race and how campaigns are, the nature of campaigns. Yet I take it that your organization, Braver Angels, believes this can be overcome.
You know, so I don't want to oversell what we can do. And I think that anyone who's been involved with Braver Angels would tell you that we're all concerned about our country, but we think it can be made better. And we think that it's important to try to make it better. And I think this might be a good place for me to note that one of the things that we're not trying to do is we're not trying to change anyone's political opinions. Sometimes people think, oh, well, you've got to be a political moderate to participate in Braver Angels. And that's just absolutely not true. We're not aiming for some kind of mushy middle that we're trying to push everybody toward. And we're not even trying to get us to not disagree, because I think we all know that healthy a disagreement is good for democracy. The problem is that the disagreement that we have now is unhealthy, and that we are in social and media silos that are actually making us a little dumber and often meaner. And so those are the kinds of things that we're trying to overcome. There's a group that does things similarly to Braver Angels, and they are called Disagree Better. And I really like that phrase. We're not going to necessarily change the fact that we may disagree with one another, but we can disagree more productively, and we can disagree without rancor, and we can also disagree without morally condemning, at least in many cases, people who don't agree with us, at least not morally condemning them for the fact that they don't agree with us.
How did this effort to depolarize us get started? How long has it been hosting these workshops?
Well, it's actually been around since 2016. So it was in the 2016 election cycle that a group of people up in Lebanon, Ohio, Reds and Blues, got together for a workshop. And the workshop, interestingly enough, was designed by a professor at, I believe it's the University of Minnesota, who specializes in marriage and family therapy. And so he designed kind of a listening and talking session for Reds and Blues. And I think the experience was so positive that Braver Angels grew out of that experience. And so the organization has been in operation since 2016. It's all volunteer, except for a very small staff. And it is grassroots. So one of the beliefs that Braver Angels embraces is that this won't come from the top. And in fact, people in the political parties sometimes have an interest in polarizing us. And so we're probably not going to get help from the political parties on this. And it's really up to every citizen to do what they can to work against this trend.
Well, I mentioned in the introduction that you're going to be holding some workshops in the area, three of them. The first is set for April 6th. Where will that happen, and what's it about?
So that's going to be at the Eastside Public Library. And let me just say, so that no one just shows up at the Eastside Public Library on April 6th, that it's necessary to register for these in advance. They are free, but people do need to register. And maybe at the end of the program, we can put that registration information out there.
For sure.
So each of the three workshops is distinct. We hope some people will come to all three. But the one on April 6th is called the Red-Blue Workshop. And that is, in fact, the one that I just mentioned that happened in Ohio back in 2016. So it's essentially the protocols and exercises that we'll be doing that day come from that workshop. And we're striving for roughly equal numbers of red and blue in that workshop. And we're going to just do a series of exercises that will help us clarify our disagreements, reduce our stereotyped thinking about one another, and in fact, discover some common values because, you know, in today's day and age, it's hard to believe that we have common values with people that we think we're so opposite from. But in fact, we do have common values, and we want to try to help people get in touch with those and see what they have in common with the other side so that they can build on it. So that's the April 6th workshop.
There was a time when elected officials mostly agreed to disagree agreeably. You touched on that earlier. Not so much these days. How do you keep things civil in a room full of people who so fundamentally disagree?
It's a great question. So the key to having these kinds of conversations is having structures in place that prevent them from going off the rails. So we have a set of structures in place that prevent that from happening. And I think, you know, you can relate it to almost any kind of conversation that feels a little dangerous. You know, sometimes families have conversations that have dangerous elements in them. And I think it's just all about having these structures in place. And so online, on social media, certainly when we encounter one another in spaces where these are not in place, people feel free to let their worst self kind of loose and feel free to vent. And this is not that. So we'll be holding people to talking about the question that we put out there, asking them not to go beyond those questions. And, you know, occasionally we have something that feels a little uncomfortable, but it's never irreparable and it never destroys what happens.
On April 27th, the focus will be depolarizing within and skills for bridging the divide. Where is that going to be? And tell us about that session.
The location for the last two workshops is still in flux, but we'll have that nailed down very soon. But the one on the 27th, Depolarizing Within and Skills for Bridging the Divide, there are three different places that we can work to depolarize, and one is within ourselves. And so we're going to start with that. How do you find ways to tell a truer story about the other side, a story that's truer than the one that we often hear? And we're going to talk about ways to counter stereotypical thinking when it arises within us. And then we're going to talk about depolarizing within our own group, because the depolarizing often happens when we talk with people who agree with us and we start saying about how awful those people are on the other side. And there are ways to complicate those conversations a little bit more. And then finally, we're going to talk about ways to talk with people on the other side. And so we'll be looking at those three different kinds of conversations with ourselves, with people in our same political tribe, so to speak, and people on the opposite side of the aisle.
The topic for June 1st is a true, true hot button. Can we agree about abortion? Lots of intense feelings on the many sides of this issue. Has it been done in other places? And if so, how did that go?
Yeah. So, you know, it seems like the scariest and most dangerous thing in the world. And so we did this in our Braver Angels chapter in Jessamine County. And I kind of thought, if we can tackle this and survive it, nothing will be able to break us apart. We'll be the most steel-proof group of people. And I have to just say that we did it. And what we came out of this workshop with is two single-spaced pages of things about abortion that we agreed about. And the trick here was that we looked up front about things we were not going to agree about. And we decided we're not going to even touch those. We're not going to agree about when life begins. And we're also not going to agree about the legality of this, of abortion. And that's okay. The truth is there's a whole lot of stuff in between those two issues that we might agree on. You know, abortion is a perfect example of a topic that's been talked about as if there are only two issues involved and as if there are only two sides. And in fact, you know, I think that what the landscape since Dobbs has taught us is that abortion's a really complicated issue and that there are a lot of different approaches and that both sides want other ways to approach the issue that aren't just about having abortion be legal or not, that there's a lot of other things that go into this. How can we support young mothers? How can we help women better plan pregnancies? So a lot of these things are things that we can agree on. And, you know, I think it's an issue that if we understand that we can find common ground on, that how can we take that and then build on it? And so I'm really excited about our ability to do this. One of the things that we're asking people that want to come for this June 1st workshop, Can We Agree About Abortion? We are encouraging them to sign up for at least one of the other two, because I don't want anyone thinking that they're just going to come in there and, you know, rant against the other side, that there are certain protocols that we're going to follow on this very intense and deeply felt topic as well.
Carolyn, it's unfortunate to have to ask this, but I'm sure some listeners, at least some who are listening to us, are wondering it themselves. What about security at these gatherings?
Yeah, we've never had any trouble. And they're all going to be in public libraries. And so I think libraries have been a place that have been the target of some animosity lately. And so I'm not worried about security at these gatherings. I think if anybody objects to Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals, people across the political spectrum objects to our getting together, well, I have to ask what their interests are, because this can only help us.
What's at stake if we fail as a country? And let's hope we don't. But if we fail as a country, as a society, to find our way back to being able to have respectful conversations about politics and public policy in particular?
So much is at stake. I don't want to go into political prognostication here. As a historian, I'm reluctant to predict the future. But I will say, I think we all know that our mental health is at stake. I led a workshop about 2 weeks ago in Western Kentucky, and a woman said in the workshop, you know, I showed up today because I realized that my level of anger toward the other side is unhealthy. And so I think our mental health is at stake. I think any kind of a society that actually works, that actually functions, is at stake. I don't think that any of us believe that the other side is going away just because our side wins an election. So if our side wins the election in November, I promise you that all those other people that didn't want us to win are still going to be there, and they're still going to have the same concerns. And if the other side wins, and here I'm just speaking broadly, then our side will still be there. And I think that we need to appreciate that we must learn to live together. And in fact, we've always lived with disagreement in this country. There is nothing that insists that the disagreements that we have now should spell doom for us. And I want us to get back in touch with that sense.
So do I. And Carolyn, you mentioned earlier a way that people can keep up with these events, where they're going to be located, times and so forth, registration in particular. Can you give us that information?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So the first place to go is on Facebook. Find our page and like it, Braver Angels Kentucky. That's the best way when we're hosting an event, a workshop. It will always be there. You can also email us at our Jessamine County Braver Angels Alliance, and that email is jessamineba@gmail.com. Let me say that again, jessamineba@gmail.com, and that's just Jessamine for Jessamine County. Just be sure to spell it right. And if people have questions, want information, for some reason can't find the registration link that's on the Facebook page, they're welcome to email us there, and I'll send all that information.
All right. Carolyn DuPont, EKU historian, Kentucky State Coordinator for Braver Angels. She leads a chapter in Jessamine County, and we really appreciate you filling us in on this really important effort that you have underway.
Well, I thank you so much for helping us get the word out about this ray of hope that we can find our ways back to caring about one another beyond our political divides.
Tell me why, tell me why, tell me why. Why can't we live together? Tell me why, tell me why. Why can't we live together? Everybody wants to live together. Why can't we live together?
Still ahead.
All right, boys, put your hands up. We got you surrounded.
Our latest 10-minute radio play coming up. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. We're back with another Eastern Standard 10-minute radio play, this one based on a true story. There have been men distilling spirits in Kentucky for hundreds of years. The year before Kentucky even became a state, violence in Pennsylvania sent hundreds of families fleeing down the Ohio River on flatboats, their stills in tow. They soon discovered that the cool limestone spring water and the fresh lowland corn here in Kentucky combined to yield a mighty fine batch of Kentucky bourbon. And so it went on for generations. Spirits were distilled on both sides of the law, right up until the 18th Amendment to the Constitution of these United States outlawed all liquor everywhere. Prohibition came down hard on the bluegrass, and raids on stills became a regular occurrence. So now listen closely as the Appalachian Center for the Arts, in collaboration with Eastern Standard and Dynamics Productions, brings you The Old Spring Box, the story of one such raid that took place on the banks of Raven Run Creek in Fayette County in the winter of 1931.
Come on. Brighten up a bit. Maybe this'll change your luck.
So far, this still of ours ain't put out nothing but rot gut. And I can't feed a family on mash.
I know, Nolan, but we can't make this old scow land produce any more than it does. Anyways, we ain't gonna be farming nothing in February.
Shh, girl. I hear you, John. We just gotta make this still pay. Come on, girl, be quiet. The only thing I feel more than hunger is guilt.
Ain't nothing to feel guilty about.
When I married Ethel, I told you I'd take care of her. And I mean to.
I know you do. Now.
And what? I work every day trying to keep her fed.
Best let that lie.
And ever since she lost the baby,
Nolan, I don't want to speak no more of it. I got mouths to feed, same as you.
But I just...
Talking about starving don't make it stop. Best you can do is put your mind to toting that poke of corn.
Well, Mr. Clark, sir, do you think we'll get us some moonshiners today? I saw out in Wolf County, they shot three of them just last week. The paper done up a whole spread on them.
Sweeney, I told you to call me WF.
Oh, yes, sir. You know, I reckon these woods are chock full of stills. These dirt farmers got nothing better to do. I bet every stream from here to the county line is crawling with them.
Boy, you're greener than the first of May. You better pray we don't run into anything meaner than a stray dog.
Oh, yes, sir. WF, sir. But you better believe I know every crook and cranny out this way, and if they're out here, we'll find them sure as spit. Sir?
What?
Where are we going?
We'll turn off Jack's Creek Pike in about a half a mile and go past the old Prather house. After that, we can cut across the fields down toward the river.
Is that where their still is?
That's where the informer said a still might be.
Hot damn!
Boy, calm yourself.
What'd she see?
Who knows? Squirrel, I reckon. She'll be back.
All right. We're almost there. Pass me that poke of corn. I'll tote it up the hill to the old spring box.
Ooh, There. You got it?
Yeah.
All right. Let's head up the hill.
I'm right behind you.
You sure picked a thorny patch of weeds to hide your still in.
Yeah, well, had to be sure no one'd stumble on it. There's a lot of damned nosy people about these days.
Yeah, but I get all tore up every time we come out here.
We got to protect our investment. And this old shotgun ain't gonna do much.
It's all right. Lady here will protect us. Won't you, girl?
If that dog of yours is supposed to protect us, we're as good as dead.
Uh-huh. All right. We're here.
Whew. Spring water's as cold as ever.
You'll catch your death dunking your head in water like that in wintertime.
That'll wake you right up.
Whoever carved this old spring box out of the ground sure did us a favor.
I'll say. Some old homesteader must have found a little trickle of water there and dug it out. Yeah, 4 feet wide and 4 feet deep.
Whoever it was did a fine job laying out the limestone blocks for the walls and the basin.
Now we got all the fresh water we could ever use.
And all we had to do is clear away some weeds.
Best get a fire going. Don't want to waste the day.
That's right. All this farmland used to be forest. It was harvested for lumber after the war between the states.
Is that so?
Now, if there's a still, it'll be in a thick cut of woods down somewhere there's plenty of water.
Well, where did the informer say it was?
He didn't draw us a map, Sweeney. And besides, you can't believe everything you hear. Did you ever think about why someone would turn in their neighbor like that?
I guess I didn't think on it, W.F.
Well, you can't believe everything you hear.
Did you hear that?
I did.
Well, all I'm saying is, I don't see what's so great about it.
I think they're calling it the Great Depression because it's so bad. Times aren't just hard here. Times are hard everywhere.
Well, what am I supposed to do about it?
Nothing we can do about it. Unlike that fire. Don't stoke it too much. We don't want it getting too hot. This old still is finicky.
I know it.
Ow! Don't burn yourself, neither.
Do you smell that?
Yeah. Smoke. And a lot of it. Looks like it's coming from down the hill a ways.
What do you think it is?
Go easy now. You may catch you them moonshiners you've been talking about. Oh.
Hellfire, Nolan. Are you trying to smoke us out?
It ain't my fault. Half the woods dry as dirt, and half the woods green as grass.
That's them! That's them!
Shh! Stay low, stay close. We'll creep in behind them.
All right, boys, put your hands up. We got you surrounded.
Yeah!
What the?
Who's there?
I can't see them!
Freeze! Hands up!
Nolan, run!
Fire! Hold your fire.
He ran.
Yeah.
Are they dead?
Yeah, or will be shortly.
Oh.
Well, Sweeney, it'll make the paper, but there ain't nobody to take no pictures.
Our two young moonshiners, John and Nolan, died within minutes. However, Nolan's young wife, Ethel, lived on to the age of 91. Neither patrolman W.F. Clark nor Constable Carl Sweeney were harmed in the shootout that day, and history doesn't record the fate of Lady the Dog. Just 2 years later, Prohibition was repealed, and today, Kentucky bourbon and the moonshining tradition are cultural staples in the bluegrass. This has been The Old Spring Box by Seth Miller, produced by the Appalachian Center for the Arts in collaboration with Eastern Standard and Dynamics Productions. Our thanks to Appalachian Center for the Arts, Pikeville, and its actors, Marcus McGee as Nolan Lamb, Derek Hess as John Martin, Malcolm Gabriel Johnson as Constable Carl Sweeney, Robert Daniels as Patrolman W.F. Clark, Seth Miller, playwright, Crockett Ward, director, Bill McCann, production coordinator, music by Mark Glenhofer. And I'm Tom Martin. Coming up next week on episode 3 of our election year series, Democracy Optimist.
What we need to do is think broadly about how can we expand voting rights so that we have protection for everyone.
Did you know that the U.S. Constitution does not explicitly confer the right to vote to everyone?
The words right to vote don't even appear until after the Civil War, and they're generally phrased in the negative.
Our guests, UCLA law professor Richard Hazen, one of the nation's preeminent election law experts, joined by Harvard law professor Lawrence Lessig, co-author of How to Steal a Presidential Election.
We basically outsource our choice for president to 6 states, which are not representative of America at all.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. And thanks to Steve Winwood for his version of Why Can't We Live Together? We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more, and you can sign up there for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.